thus Joseph to himself. The furnishings of the little house were in the same heavenly good taste, an elegant long couch of ebony and ivory, resting on lion's claws, spread with panther and lynx skins and strewn with soft cushions, roomy armchairs with backs of gilded leather stamped in fine designs, full of embroidered cushions, and with fat footstools to match. Bronze incense stands giving off priceless savor. This interior, so comfortable, domestic, and inviting, was at the same time a chapel and place of worship. For on a raised platform at the back were offerings of flowers and little silver teraphim with the crowns of gods on their tiny heads, while various cult objects showed that their rite was observed. So then Joseph knelt down to be in readiness in the corner by the entrance, setting his burden on the mat before him to rest his arms. But before long he hastily lifted it and stiffened his pose, for Huia and Tuia were scuffling in their beak-toed sandals across the garden, each supported on the arm of a child servant. The two little maids had arms like thin sticks, and mouths that hung foolishly open, for the brother-sister pair would have only such to wait on them. These, then, helped the old people up the terrace and into the house. Huia was the brother, and Tuia the sister.
"First before our lords," old Huia ordered in a husky voice, "and to bow before them."
Just so,
old Tuia agreed. She had a large, pale, oval face.
"Before our gods, first of all, that we may pray their leave before taking our ease in our chairs in the peace of this summer house."
And they had the children lead them over before the teraphim, where they lifted their withered hands and bent still more their bended backs, for age had bowed and buckled the spines of both. Huia, the brother, had an unsteady head. It shook a good deal, up and down, as well as sometimes sidewise. Tuia's neck was still steady. On the other hand, her eyes had retreated in her face till they were a mere pair of blind, colorless slits. A fixed smile sat on her large face. After the parents had prayed, the little maids led them to the chairs which stood ready in the foreground of the little house, and let them sink cautiously down. They took their feet and set them on the footstools, which were laced with gold cord.
There,
Huia said in his hoarse whisper, for other voice he had not.
"Go now, maidservants, for ye have done your duty. Our feet are set, and our bones rest, and all is well. Let be, I sit. And thou too sittest, Tuia, bed-sister of mine. Then all is well. Go until we call you, and stay away, for we want to be by ourselves to enjoy the sweet hour of late afternoon and early evening, as the light rests upon reeds and duck-pond, and to look across the avenue to the towers of the gate in the strong wall. We want to be quiet, and sitting thus, seen and heard by nobody, to talk to each other in the familiar phrases of old age."
Meanwhile, Joseph, with his dish, was kneeling in his corner, diagonally opposite to them, and quite near. But he well knew that he was nothing but a dumb waiter, in presence like a piece of furniture, and no more. With glassy eyes he gazed past their old heads.
"Go, little maids, obey the mild command," said Tuia.
In contrast with her brothers, she possessed a clear, soft voice.
"Go and wait just so near and so far that ye shall hear our hands clap when we call you. For if weakness should come over us, or death surprise us, we will clap our hands in sign that you are to come, and let the soul birds to flutter out of our mouths."
The little maids prostrated themselves and went. Huia and Tuia sat beside each other in their chairs, a beringed old hand of each clasping the other's on the inside arm. They wore their gray hair, the color of much tarnished silver, just alike. It fell in thin strands from the scantily covered head, over their ears, nearly down to their shoulders. But Sister Tuia had made an attempt to twist the strands together by twos and threes into a sort of decoration, which did not come to much because of the thinness of the hair. Huia, on the other hand, had a little beard of the same dull silver on the underside of his chin, and he wore gold earrings that showed through his hair, while Tuia's old head was crowned with a broad band in a petal design in black and white enamel, which one would have liked better on a younger head. For we feel that beautiful things belong to youth and freshness, and jealously grudge them to a head which is already nearly a skull. In other respects, too, Betapre's mother was elegantly dressed. Her pure white robe was cut like a shepherd's cape at the neck, and girdled with a beautiful ribbon embroidered in bright colors, its lyre-shaped ends hanging nearly to her feet. A wide necklace of the same black-and-white enamel as her head ornament covered her age-shrunk breast. In her left hand she held a bunch of lotus blossoms, and carried them now and then to her brother's nose.
"Smell them, my treasure," she said. "Sniff the sacred flowers, lovely gift of the swamp. Comfort thyself with their scent of anise after the tiring walk from the upper story to this beautiful spot."
"Thanks, twin sister and bride," old Huia answered hoarsely. He was well wrapped in a mantle of fine white wool. "Enough, let be. I have smelt, and I am refreshed. Thy health," said he, bowing over her like a stiff old nobleman.
"And thine," she replied.
Then they sat silent a while, blinking into the beauty of the garden, the bright perspective of pond and avenue and flowery meadows, with the towered gate at the end. And old Brother Huia blinked even more anciently than his sister bride, with weary eyes like lights gone out. He chewed ceaselessly with his toothless jaws, and his little beard bobbed evenly up and down. Tuia did no such mumbling. Her large face was calm, the head a little on one side, and the little cracks of eyes seemed to share in her permanent smile. Very likely she was skilled at raising her husband's spirits and bringing him back to awareness of the world about him, for she said,
"Yes, my little old bullfrog, here we sit, and the silver gods are good to us. Our slim young maids have settled us dutifully in the cushions of these fine chairs, and slipped away, so that we are alone together like the divine pair in the mother's womb. Only in our hole it is not dark, and we may feed upon its pleasantness, the pretty pictures and the well-made furniture. Lo, they have set our feet on broidered footstools, as a reward for having trod the earth so many weary years, all four together. But if we lift our eyes, we can see the beautiful disk of the sun spreading its bright wings above the entrance to our hole, flanked by cobras. Horus, lord of the lotus, son of the dark embrace. The shapely alabaster lamp by the sculptor Merim Opet they have set on a stand to our left, and in the right-hand corner kneels the dumb waiter with dainties in his hands, prepared for our desire. Hast thou yet desire, my bittern?"
Frightfully hoarse came the brother's reply,
"I desire already, dear mudlark, but I mistrust my mind and palate, lest it is they that desire, and not my stomach, which might rise up against food with cold sweat and deadly anguish if I feed it before time. It is better we should wait until we are weary of sitting and have actual need."
"Thou art right, Buttercup," answered she, her voice sounding very full and soft after his. "Check thy appetite. That is wiser. Thou wilt still live long, nor will the dumb waiter run away with the cordials. Look, he is young and pretty. He is as choice as all the other things with which they surround our old eyes. Garlanded is he like a wine-jug, with tree-blossoms, flowers from the reeds, and flowers from the beds. His pretty black eyes gaze past thine ear. They look not on the place where we sit, but at the background, and thus into the future. Dost thou understand my play with words?
It is easy to understand,
old Huia strained his voice to croak,
for thy words point to the purpose of this charming little hut, where, for a while, the dead of the house always lie, behind us, in front of the silver ones in their shrines, on well-shaped trestles, after they have been disemboweled, after the doctors and embalmers have filled them with nard and rolled them in bandages, and before they are borne in their ship up the river to Abdu, where he himself lieth buried, and been given their splendid burial, such as that they make for Hapi and Merwer, and for Pharaoh, and are shut up in their good eternal dwelling, and its columned rooms, where their own life smiles at them in color from all the walls.
Right, my swamp beaver, Tuia rejoined. Thy mind is clear, and clearly hast thou grasped the play of my words, as I also can understand thy meaning in a trice, whatever the figure thou clothest it in. For we play on each other's minds, being an old brother-sister pair who have played together all the games of life. First, those of childhood, and then those that a man and a woman play together. Thy old mole takes no shame to say it, for we are here alone in the house, and are as one.
Yes, yes, said old Huia, with apologetic haste, for our life was life together from the beginning unto the end. We were much in the world, and among the people of the world, for we are nobly born and near the throne. But at bottom we were always alone together in the little house, the house of our brother-sisterhood, as we are in this one here, first in the mother's womb, then in the house of childhood, and in the dark room of marriage. Now we two old folks sit here and gaze at the dainty decorations of this little house, so lightly built, our refuge for a day. But the eternal refuge awaiteth us in the pillared cave in the west, which shall shelter us through all time, through unnumbered jubilees, while the dreams of life smile down upon us from the dark walls.
Right, my good house wren, Tuia agreed. But is it not strange that at this hour we still sit here in our chairs in the front of this little temple and talk to each other? Yet, in but a little while, we shall be resting at the back, on lion-footed trestles in our wrappings, with feet pointed up, and have our faces outside once more, with the little god-beard on our chins. Usir Huia, and Usir Tuia. And above us, sharp-eared Anpu will bend.
Very queer, no doubt, croaked old Huia. But for myself, I see it not so clearly, and shrink from the strain on my head, for it is tired. But thine is still strong in thoughts and steady on thy neck. That makes me misgive, lest thou and thy freshness might not depart when I do, but sit in thy chair while I take the narrow path alone.
Have no fear, my kingfisher, answered she. Thy little old mole will not leave thee alone, and shouldst thou breathe thy last before her, a draught of physic will congeal the life in her veins, and we shall still be together. For I must certainly be at thy side after death, to prompt thee in the reasons and justifications at the judgment.
Will there be judgment? Asked old Huia uneasily.
We must expect it, answered she. So the law teaches. But there is doubt, whether it still hath full authority. There are laws which are like old houses. They endure and stand upright, but no one lives in them any more. I have questioned Beknekons, Amun's great prophet, how it may be in the hall of the judging goddesses, with the scale for the weighing of the heart, and the hearing in the presence of him of the West, at whose side sit the 42 frightfully named. Beknekons's words were unclear. The law stands, so he told thy mole, for all standeth to everlasting in the land of Egypt, the old as well as the new set up beside it, the land being thick with laws, images, and buildings, with living and dead, and one moves among them in decency and propriety. For the dead is the more holy, only in that it is dead, the mummified truth, to be preserved everlasting to the people, even though it is forsaken by the spirit of the newly taught. Thus spoke Beknekons the wise, but he is very much the servant of Amun, and zealous for his god. The king of the lower regions, with the fan and crooked staff, about him he troubles less, and the teachings and tales that are told about him he cares for but little. He may call them a forsaken building and mummified truth. But there is no certainty that we must not come before them, as the common folk believe, to declare our innocence and have our hearts weighed in the scale, before Tot absolve us of the 42 sins, and the Son take our hands to lead us to the Father. We must reckon with the chance, and therefore must thy wise little old owl be at thy side in death as in life, to take the word in her mouth when we stand before the throne and explain our deeds to the frightfully named, lest thou forget the reasons, and thy head fail thee at the great moment. For my little buck-bat is even now sometimes cloudy in his mind.
Do not say so, Huia burst out more hoarsely than ever. For if my head is tired and foggy, it is because I have pondered so long and hard upon the reasons and the explanation. But even a foggy mind may talk of the matters which make it foggy. For was it not I who thought and spoke in the sacred darkness of the sacrifice and the atonement? That canst thou not deny. It was I, for I am the man, thy brother husband, and the begetter between us two. Dark indeed in the holy darkness of the nuptial chamber, but not too dark or foggy in his mind that he could not light up the ancient darkness with the idea of making part payment to the holy new law.
Have I denied it? Tuir replied. Nay, that thy old bride denies not at all. Truly it was her old knave of dark corners who first begot the idea of drawing a line between the holy old and the splendid new, in other words, the worldly, which mayhap may be the order of the new day. We might have to reckon with it, and so it behooved us to make offering and atonement. For thy old mould-warp saw it not, she said, turning her large face this way and that, as the blind do. I was reposing in the holy old, and unable to understand anything of the new order.
Not so, Huia contradicted her, croaking, for thou didst see it as soon as I brought it up. Thou art quick to receive, if not to invent, and thou hast well understood thy brother's plan and his concern over the new order and the age. How else shouldst thou have agreed to the sacrifice and the payment? And when I say agreed, the word is not enough. Rather, I had but to tell thee my worry concerning the age and the order of the day, and thou camest of thyself on the idea of consecrating the dark sun of our holy wedlock to the splendid new time
and of withdrawing him from the old.
How canst thou say so?
The old woman asked, bridling.
Thou crafty old corncrake, to say that it was I who had the idea. Thou wilt be putting it off on me when we stand below before the king and the frightfully named. What a sly old fox! For at most I but understood and conceived after thou, the man, hadst begot. As I received from thee our Horus, our little son of the dark, Petipre the courtier, whom we turned into a son of the light, and vowed him to the lordly new, according to thy own notion, which was from thee, though I brooded and bore it as Eset the mother. And now cometh the judgment, and when we stand before the judge, and it may prove that our deed was wrong and false, thou wilt make it seem that not thou, but I conceived and bore it of myself alone.
Stuff and nonsense, he answered in an angry croak. It is well and good we are alone, and no one can hear the folly thou art prattling. For have I not myself said that I was the man, and that I lighted our darkness with the idea? How canst thou then put on me the meaning that begetting and bearing are the same, though they are indeed in the swamps and the black river mud, where the mother stuff breweth and giveth itself to its own embrace and fructifieth in the darkness, but not in the world above, where it is so that the man must visit the woman? His voice gave out. He coughed and mumbled with his jaws. His head shook violently. Might it not, dear old Mother Frog, he said, be time to summon the dumb waiter to refresh us? Thy green frog feels worn out with all this thinking, and his strength is sapped by the effort to make clear the motives and the justification.